Sometimes, gang, you can't get your economic news without a healthy dose of politics. That's just the way the system works. The 5 days gone by is where we start from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 24th day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I know that I've been saying this a lot lately, but so much to talk about, so little time. Another week in the American economy. Catherine Rampell is here. She is at the Washington Post. Also, Neela Richardson from Redfin. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai. Hi.
So let's do this. Let's start with a piece of tape today from the president of these United States speaking at the Conservative Political Action Conference today. And then we'll riff on that from there. Here he is.
We are going to massively lower taxes on the middle class, reduce taxes on American business, and make our tax code more simple and much more fair for everyone, including the people and the business.
So, syntactical errors aside, Catherine, talk to me for a second about the big domestic stuff that the president seems not to be getting a lot of traction on. Tax reform, Obamacare, the infrastructure plan has been put off now, it looks like, till 2018. And yet the market seems to be hanging on his every word. So what now happens?
Well, bear in mind that he still has not put out plans for any of those things. So it's not as if he has put out a proposal and it has been rejected. Mm-hmm. The issue is that on all of these major domestic initiatives, there's very little agreement, even among Republicans, about what to do. Like, for example, Obamacare.
Yeah.
The Republicans have had years to come up with a plan. And there have been plans proposed, but not that can unite the party and not that will appease voters.
Right.
So the challenge for the president and for his co-partisans on the Hill right now is to actually put together some proposals and with details specifically. That can get through.
Right. And details are what has been lacking from Mr. Trump's agenda virtually since the day he declared. But, Neela, let me ask you this. The economy writ large, right? I know I speak about it as a living thing, but people are counting on certain things happening. Item one being a gigantic infrastructure fiscal stimulus, which it became clear this week is not going to show up until 2018. There are things that are not happening that people are counting on.
Kai, the economy is a living thing, and many Trump supporters are counting on these policies to change their current life status. And so the infrastructure spending bill was not just about roads and bridges. It was to stimulate an economy that has been stuck at 2% growth for a very long time. The idea of the stimulus, the idea of fiscal spending, was to spur economic growth to the targets that Trump promised, upwards of 3.5%. Right now, there is nothing in place to drive the economy forward. And so lives are at stake, the lives of the people who voted for President Trump.
Catherine, about those promises and specifically economic growth and the numbers that the administration is using, you wrote a column this week based on some stories in The Wall Street Journal and your own reporting about how the White House is using the numbers to its own advantage. Describe that a little.
To put it mildly.
Yeah, well, I'm trying.
I would call it forecasting by fiat, basically. So what they're doing is rather than going through the arduous process of compiling an economic model and then figuring out, like, what do we expect labor force to look like? What do we expect productivity to look like? Blah, blah, blah. And then using that to forecast economic growth, they are just saying, we are going to have economic growth of 3 to 3.5%. And then you guys backfill the numbers to get everything to add up, which is not only, bad economics just in terms of process, but is way far off from what anybody else is forecasting. If you look at the Congressional Budget Office, the Fed, the blue chip, this is like a full percentage point higher than what other outside forecasters are predicting for the economy. So it's almost laughable. But the reason why they need to do this, of course, is that otherwise they can't get the numbers to add up because the hole that would be blown in the budget as a result of the major tax cuts that he wants, just to name one example, would be enormous if you don't assume ridiculous growth.
Right. Which gets us back, Neela, to this idea of congressional Republicans and whether they're going to let him blow up the deficit with these tax cuts and his programs.
We haven't seen a lot of resistance yet because we haven't had a lot of details yet. You know, President Trump will go before Congress in a very short while here, and he'll lay out hopefully a detailed plan. And we'll also get some interaction to see just how cohesive this Republican Party is. And I have to say, to pick up on Catherine's point about the math not working and the data's not working as well, an economist would help with that. As an economist, I can speak point. So far, Trump has not nominated an economist to serve in this role of getting the forecast right for the White House. And he's actually demoted that position from his cabinet choice. This is a key missing link in his economic policy, this staff member. And so I'm eager to see who he picks to fill this position.
So are we all. Neela Richardson at Redfin, Catherine Rampell at The Washington Post. Another week in the new economy. Thanks, you two.
Thank you, Kai.
All right, we'll talk soon. Have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, they are still loving the upside potential of the Trump administration. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. While conservatives have CPAC this week, Democrats have their own thing going. The Democratic National Committee is going to be choosing a new chair on Saturday. It is not going to be as unified, shall we say, a gathering as CPAC. There have been some fractures in the Democratic Party of late, as you know, the Clinton people, the Bernie people, and a lot of energy coming from people just protesting the current administration, all of which add up to a political business model problem, as Marketplace's Mario Segarra reports.
When it comes to raising money, the Democratic Party would probably have an easier time if it didn't have so many factions. Larry Sabato is the director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics.
If the Hillary faction starts fighting again with the Sanders faction, which starts fighting with the Elizabeth Warren faction and all the others, then obviously the DNC will be in deep trouble, and so will its fundraising.
The two leading candidates for DNC chair at the moment are Minnesota Representative Keith Ellison and former Labor Secretary Tom Perez, with other candidates running as well. But no matter who the DNC chooses, some Democrats are bound to be disappointed, and that could hurt fundraising efforts. Robert Y. Shapiro is a professor of government at Columbia University.
Some Democrats might be more oriented to give toward the party if the party stands for one thing rather than another thing.
But the DNC raised more than $372 million for the 2016 election, more than in the past two presidential election cycles. And Sabato says there's a great unifier for the Democrats, President Donald Trump.
The intensity of opposition to Donald Trump and his presidency among Democrats really spans the divisions and heals the divisions to a certain degree in the Democratic Party.
He says the DNC has an opportunity to bring in small dollar donations from the people who've been organizing and showing up to protests since the election, like January's Women's March. Julia Azari, who teaches political science at Marquette University, says that might be hard.
Even though people are, you know, really partisan in the current political environment, that doesn't always mean they like parties.
When those people aren't happy with the party, they know they can donate directly to causes they care about or individual candidates instead. And that'll be one of the biggest challenges for the new chair of the DNC. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
While the president was the big draw at CPAC today, it was the Reince and Steve show yesterday. Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, Chief Strategist Steve Bannon, in a political duet centered on a theme of economic nationalism. Or, as Bannon puts it, regaining, and this is a quote, sovereignty. That's an idea not just at the center of this administration's worldview. It's got currency on the political left as well, and also in Europe. So from Washington, Marketplace Scott Tong deconstructs the argument.
Sovereignty. Merriam-Webster says it's freedom from external control, autonomy. From what? From global trade and open border deals, at least for this administration, says Daniel McCarthy, editor-at-large of the journal The American Conservative.
These trade deals tend to supersede U.S. law and U.S. regulatory authority. And then beyond that, it's also a loss of control in terms of our economic destiny to a kind of transnational elite.
An unelected elite of bureaucrats that has taken the wheel, his argument goes. Now, most economists frame it differently, that the benefits of open trade and borders, cheaper TVs, raspberries in the winter, exceed the costs of the jobs lost. As for turning away from trade, well, there is a relevant history, warns economist Ken Reinert at George Mason University.
When countries turn inward, economic activity is decreasing, and that leads to increasing levels of nationalism. Usually, this includes war. This is generally not a good scenario.
Now, though, the anti-global sovereignty view has currency not just on the political right in the U.S., but also on the far left and also in Europe. Meantime, this whole globalization thing, it may have peaked anyway. Economist Greg Wright is with the University of California, Merced.
For the last, 10 years or so almost, net immigration from, Latin America has been, now it's even, a net negative. More people from those countries are leaving than are coming. And at the same time, we have global trade seems to be on the decline a little bit as well.
Today, the president said there is no global flag. It may be imaginary, but it also may be coming down. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Let's talk immigration here for a second. Legal immigration is what we're talking about, the kind where people coming here have to get visas, and more specifically, non-immigrant visas, ones that aren't intended to lead to green cards and permanent residency. H-1Bs are the ones that get most of the press, visas that let highly skilled foreign workers come to the States, the visas that technology companies are always angling to make more available and easier to get. But the fact is, there is a whole slew of lesser-known visas that bring hundreds of thousands of foreign workers and companies to this country. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that story.
Just over a year ago, two young executives in Bangalore, the Silicon Valley of India, made a big decision. They would expand their app company, RNF Technologies, to the U.S.
California was, of course, an obvious choice, the sixth, seventh largest economy in the world by GDP.
That's Associate Vice President Nitish Sood.
And, primarily tech-oriented state, so, it only made sense for us to be here.
So Sood and his partner Imran Ali pulled together their business plan, booked their tickets, and headed to Los Angeles. They were feeling pretty good about things until they landed in Dubai and were greeted by the sight of a plane that had skidded off the runway and was now on fire.
We looked at each other and said, maybe it's not the best idea to be taking a flight to the U.S. right now. Maybe this is nature and God telling us a different path. And I keep telling this Imran that, maybe that was a sign.
But they made it here to sunny L.A. and started putting together their application for an L-1 visa. It would allow them to set up a branch and work in California for up to 7 years. Again, here's Ali.
It is definitely a very, very cumbersome process. Our application alone, just for each person, it was about 900-odd pages.
They had to file a 5-year business plan in meticulous detail. And just to prove they're really serious, they needed a couple $100,000 in the bank and a lease on office space. John Kastravi is an immigration lawyer in Los Angeles. He says to get an L-1, you practically have to set up a business before you can even apply.
It is a gamble because you can invest all this money, and it does happen, and you get denied, and all of a sudden you're out the money and your investment.
In 2015, about 6,000 people were denied L-1 visas, and roughly 80,000 were approved as foreign companies expanded and brought workers to the U.S. And that's just the L-1.
I think the whole immigration system is completely unknown to the general public.
Yeah, and it's an alphabet soup. H-1C visas for nurses, P-1s for athletes, O-1s for people with extraordinary skills in, say, art or science, and not to mention the H-1B for skilled workers. Hundreds of thousands of employment-based visas are issued each year. But the Trump administration's draft executive order on foreign workers could put limitations on some of those visas.
What those limitations will look like, we don't really know.
Scott McVarish is a lawyer with the Immigration Law Office of Los Angeles. He says what we do know is the administration has said it wants to prioritize the interests of American workers, their jobs, wages, and well-being. That could mean more site visits at companies using L-1 visas. It could also mean reforms to the J-1 for summer workers and the E-2 for new ventures. McVarish says for business, all that uncertainty,
it becomes part of your calculation, and I think companies that want to be conservative about things will simply not come here.
There is acknowledgement that reforms are needed in some visa programs. Daniel Costa is an immigration expert with the Economic Policy Institute.
There's been just countless cases of labor trafficking and worker abuse and workers not being paid the wages they were supposed to be paid, not being in the jobs they were supposed to be in.
Costa says a better approach would be to bring in workers to fill labor shortages and...
You wouldn't keep them on a temporary status for very long. You'd put them on a quick path to permanent residence and citizenship.
Sood and Ali, the Indian business partners, aren't concerned with that now. They're focused on expanding. Their super detailed business plan calls for hiring hundreds of U.S. workers over the next few years.
Things have, you know, gotten easier for us in terms of being able to grow, and being physically present in the U.S. is just going to literally put things on steroid mode.
That is, once they get the green light on their L1 visas. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And when somebody's in that place and can't see a thing, they're going to tweet about it in seconds, and it's a PR disaster.
And economics is going to be no help. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 11 points on this Friday, less than a 10th percent, 20,821. The NASDAQ gained 9 points, about a 10th percent, 58.45. S&P up 3, a 10th percent, 23.67. For the week, 5 days gone by, the Dow up 9-tenths percent, NASDAQ up 10%, the S&P 500 up 0.7%. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise slumped 6.9% today. The tech equipment maker sales fell below analyst expectations. Company cited the strong dollar as one factor in its disappointing results. Department store chain JCPenney rolled down 5.8% today after posting a bigger than expected drop in same-store sales last quarter. Yeah, I get that right, but I get the beginning of the sentence wrong. Also, by the way, closing about 140 stores. That'll do it to you. Web-based search company Baidu clicked down 5.1% as revenue fell for a second straight quarter. You're listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on this program every day,
technology, the economy, pop culture,
check out our podcast. It's called Make Me Smart. Me and Molly Wood.
We've got new episodes every week. Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts.
Follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdal.
And I'm at Molly Wood.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We did a story last year about the Obama administration phasing out the federal use of private prisons after reports of safety and security problems in those prisons. That was last year. Yesterday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions changed the government's mind. Share prices of the companies involved reacted accordingly because, as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports, private prisons are a growth industry.
Last summer, the Obama Department of Justice said private prisons, quote, simply don't provide the same level of correctional services, programs, and resources. Bob Leibel is with the advocacy organization Grassroots Leadership.
We have seen medical neglect. We have seen unsafe conditions, unsanitary conditions.
Private prisons is a $5 billion a year industry, with the two largest companies called CoreCivics and Geo. Their stock prices plummeted after the Obama administration announcement last year, but those same stocks wheeled right back around and have kept climbing under the Trump administration, especially with his crackdown on undocumented immigrants and increased activity from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. In a conference call this week, Geo executive Dave Donahue said business is picking up.
As has been widely reported, ICE has been experiencing a significant surge in activity along the southern border for several months. This surge, along with new policies, priorities under the new administration, has created an increased need for detention bed space.
Isaac Boltansky with the investment bank Compass Point says that need is driving growth.
It is an ideal political climate to operate a private prison. It doesn't make me feel good to say that, but that's the reality.
Boltansky says it's simple math. More people will be detained and more people will be locked up. And the Trump administration has made it clear private prisons should and will play a key role. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
There's a new art exhibit in Washington, D.C. that's got curators at the Smithsonian's Hirshhorn Museum bracing for record crowds. The works of Yayoi Kusama, one of those rare living artists who draws collectors and critics and crowds by the millions. Which sounds great for the Hirshhorn, but there is a catch. Kusama creates her installations in tiny little rooms that only a handful of people at a time can get into. Were this a normal situation, economics would have an easy supply-demand-ish answer. You just raise the ticket price. But as Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains, this is no normal situation.
Stepping inside one of Kusama's infinity mirror rooms is a singular experience. The reflective glass pulls off quite a trick, turning a tiny room into an endless fantasy landscape of multicolored orbs and shapes. It's not easy to describe the streaming color and glowing lights. You have to experience it, which is why this could be such a powerful draw for the Hirshhorn.
I'm very, very excited, little nervous as well.
Museum Deputy Director Elizabeth Dugal surveys the gallery as workers make final preparations just hours before it opens to massive crowds. It sounds like a great chance to profit from the demand, but it doesn't work that way here.
The mission of the Smithsonian Institution is that the museums are free to the public, and this has been in our mission for over 150 years.
When charging is out of the question, the museum has to find more creative ways to manage the storms of supply and demand. The Hirshhorn decided to do something it has never done in its entire history, timed tickets. Visitors have to sign up days in advance. When the first batch of tickets went up for grabs online, 9,000 passes disappeared in minutes. One way around the system is membership, which starts at $50. By the eve of the opening, the membership base had grown by 20 times.
Now that we have all these new members, we have new emails and ways to contact these folks and to get them engaged and stay engaged with the museum.
It also means 20 times as many people to hit up for donations. Outside the museum in the garden, no tickets are needed to see Kusama's sculpture Pumpkin, a giant yellow gourd covered in dark polka dots. Even early in the morning, people steadily file by taking selfies. Her visually stunning works are tempting bait for social media fans. That makes the Kusama exhibition potential gold at a time when younger visitors are coveted.
I think there's a lot riding on it for the Hirshhorn.
Jimena Varela takes in the sculpture from a nearby bench. As director of American University's Arts Management Program, she tracks how art museums work to attract the next generation of visitors and members. Blockbuster exhibitions like this can be turning points, but only if the museum delivers. That means keeping the public happy. No easy thing when they can't all go in when they want and face long lines once they get there.
Today with social media, when somebody's in that place and can't see a thing, and everyone around them can't see a thing, they're going to tweet about it in seconds, and it's a PR disaster.
Back in the gallery, keeping those visitors happy is the job of Samir Batar, who works across the Smithsonian's museums.
2 years in the making, and now it's happening, so I'm a little anxious.
Planning for Yayoi Kusama involved outside consultants, additional facilities, and tripling the number of visitor staffing. The show could double the usual attendance, with hundreds of thousands of people hungry to step into rooms that only hold three or four. That means very short visits, 30 seconds tops, and very long lines. The museum has put special care into giving people something to experience while they're waiting.
There's a video projection here to grab your attention, which is a work of hers, actually, the late 60s. There is some text here.
It's understandable if you're skeptical of all the hype around Kusama's work, so I wanted Jimena Varela's perspective. She's the American University professor we talked to earlier. She's been inside lots of exhibits around the world, but never in one of Kusama's rooms until right now.
I've seen them in two dimensions in a picture, and they look amazing.
I kept quiet while she went inside and didn't ask any questions until she stepped out.
It's absolutely worth the wait because when you step into it, I think you forget the wait.
If hundreds of thousands of people feel the same way, the museum will have cracked a tricky economic problem and maybe built a stronger future. In Washington, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, one more item from President Trump's speech at CPAC this morning. It's a follow of sorts to our update yesterday on our series. Remember, it's called Things the President of the United States Says at Meetings. Here you go.
But we're taking meetings every day with top leaders in business, in science and industry. Yesterday I had
29 of the biggest business leaders in the world in my office. Caterpillar, Tractor, Campbell's Soup. We had everybody. We had everybody. I like Campbell's Soup.
I like Campbell's Soup. But seriously, the sodium, check the labels, man. All right, we are out of here. Close business today. The Dow up 11 points, less than a tenth percent. That's 10, maybe 11 straight days up for the blue chips. The NASDAQ gained 9 points, about a tenth percent. S&P 500 up 3 points there, a tenth or so percent. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.